Welcome to the SF Squeecast, in which a group of science fiction and fantasy professionals squee about things SF-nal in a never-ending panel discussion of vague positivity. I'm Lynn Thomas, your moderator. Today, I am joined by the entire cast of Squeecast regulars, Elizabeth Baer.
Hi.
Paul Cornell.
Hello.
Shauna McGuire.
Hello.
And Catherine Valenti.
Hey.
This is a very special episode because we are celebrating the wintry holiday season. Hooray!
Ho, ho, ho.
Grinch, Grinch, Grinch.
Merry Christmas, one and all.
So this episode ought to be fun because we're going to be talking about the holiday-themed things that we enjoy. Now, we all celebrate holidays in slightly different ways. So whether it is a solstice or a Christmas or a Kwanzaa or a Hanukkah or a just another day for you, we hope you enjoy it. Shannon, we thought we would start with you. Well, I thought we would start with you because I get to put things in order, being the librarian of the group. And I thought we would talk about The Nightmare Before Christmas as a place to start, which, of course, is the 1993 musical animated Tim Burton film. So, Shannon, what would you like to tell us about The Nightmare Before Christmas?
The Nightmare Before Christmas was made solely so that people like me could watch a holiday movie with our families without demanding gremlins again. But no, seriously, The Nightmare Before Christmas is one of my favorite movies of all time. I'm not really a big Christmas girl. I rail against the coming of the Christmas light like they were, in fact, proof that the apocalypse was coming. And having this beautiful combination of Halloween and Christmas is like turning Christmas into something I can't not love. The music is wonderful. The animation has held up just fantastically well because it's practical animation rather than early CGI. It's just a fantastic piece of work. The character designs are amazing. Thing. The fact that they now take over Disneyland and Disney World every Halloween is amazing. Also, it's been highly entertaining. It's one of my rare hipster moments because when this movie came out, I fell in love instantly and just told everyone you have to see it. And none of my friends liked it. None of my friends liked it. And then bit by bit over the last 15 years, they've all gone, oh my gosh, did you see this wonderful movie? And I just kind of sit there going, I like Nightmare Before Christmas before it was cool, which is always entertaining since I am not normally the one in that position.
I mean, I agree about the visual aesthetic of that movie is just amazing. It's beautiful. I love the music, but I really am not a big fan of the themes of the movie. It's always troubled me, despite that I was playing the soundtrack when the kids came trick-or-treating at my house last week. The themes really bother me. As long as we're not dealing with the fact that Jack is learning never to question the life that he is born into or try anything new because he'll just screw it up, I love the movie. But when that theme comes up, I get disturbed and I think about how much that's not a message I would want to deliver to children.
I never actually saw the theme that way. I always thought the theme was you can learn new things and you can stretch because he comes up with new ideas and he's a permanent friend of Santa's now. And it was more that I shouldn't come in and knock you down and take your toy. Because he doesn't say, hey, Santa, you want to share, you want to teach me. He's like, hey, Santa, cool.
Rock look over there.
I've got a big cage. How about you hang in it for a while? But that's a fascinating way of looking at it. And I'm going to have to go watch it like 8 times.
At once. So that was just my, and I honestly saw it like 3 years ago.
I think cat's reading is valid.
Oh, absolutely.
I think it's reading against the text a little bit.
I know that's what the movie thinks it's saying.
Yes, I don't think that's what the movie thinks it's saying. I tend to think that what the movie thinks it's saying is something more to the effect of, it's not a bad thing to like who you are, even if who you are is kind of creepy and weird.
You mean sort of like what they were trying to do with Rudolph, but Santa was such a jerk he couldn't manage it?
Oh, man. That Santa needs to be given to Oogie Boogie.
Seriously.
As long as it's the Rankin and Bass Santa up there in that cage, I'm pretty happy.
Yeah, he needs some re-education.
I always figured the Rankin and Bass Santa was upset. Because if you watch the specials in chronological order, he starts out with this really nice goth chick named Melissa, who is totally his soulmate. And then she gets whacked somewhere between Santa Claus Returns and Santa Claus Saves Christmas and is replaced by Mrs. Claus, who is not Melissa.
Hmm.
So he's pissed.
So basically Santa is a jerk because of lost love.
Yes.
Well, it's always women's fault.
Oh, that's not what I meant.
sarcastic.
Problematic readings of The Nightmare Before Christmas. I feel we should concentrate on Gremlins now and leave Sean without any Christmas joy in her life whatsoever. I think that's...
The reason that I watched it to begin with is because I'm playing Kingdom Hearts as a Halloween Town level. That is just so beautiful and wonderful, and the music was so great that I had to watch.
I've got to admit that I tend to make very deconstructive holiday mixes, and The Nightmare Before Christmas is one of the things that usually is prominent on them.
Well, the soundtrack is just incredible. The opening theme, where they're doing the orchestra in and you have all the various little bits in there, is one of the few pieces of music that can make me happy. I can be so depressed that I can't get out of bed. And if I put on the opening orchestration for Nightmare Before Christmas, I am happy again.
It is hard not to love. My personal bone to pick with the movie has a lot to do with Sally, but I would like her to have a little more agency that doesn't revolve around boys.
Yeah.
Called crazy. On the other hand, I forgive a lot for that scene where she's stitching herself back together after throwing herself out the window, because that's just such a fantastic visual metaphor for, you know, escaping a bad relationship.
Well, maybe it's time for us to move on to talking about stealth films that are not intentionally holiday films, but kind of feel like holiday films despite themselves.
I think that's a little bit backwards, Lynn.
Okay.
Because what I'm thinking of is movies that are set during the holidays, but intentionally don't feel like holiday films. And have a brief list of examples. One of them is Gremlins. Yay! There's the die-hard, running scared, Lethal Weapon trifecta. As you know, Bob, our three cop movies, all of them set during Christmas, all of which have nothing to do with Christmas. They're just about blowing stuff up.
Wait, really? They're set during Christmas?
Yeah, all three of them are set during Christmas. The original Running Scared, the one with Gregory Hines and Billy Crystal, not the other one.
Yeah, well, the purpose of setting it during Christmas is just because then the Christmas lights explode in a very pretty manner as opposed to regular lights.
And it gives you a little more snarky dialogue. And also it gets to be a little bit, I think, deconstructive of the whole, and now the Christmas season, joy and peace and love and ho, 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 I've got a machine gun. It lets you have the ho, 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 I've got a machine gun joke.
I think this is perhaps because of a certain heightened sensibility around the Christmas season. That I'm reminded of the last episode of the wonderful British detective show Shoestring, where our hero, instead of relaxing like everybody else on Earth, has to do some terrible, terrible task which he solves at the last minute. And I think there's something of that to this, that our heroes in those action movies don't get to have a holiday. They get to be even more picked on.
Exactly. And there's that, you know, it also allows Running Scared to have that great climactic gunfight in the mall with the Christmas trees, which is hysterically funny. Ghostbusters 2, similar thing.
Yes.
Then there's some that I think are really intentionally deconstructive of the whole Christmas thing. LA Confidential.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't even think of that. Holiday list.
Better Off Dead, which has the worst Christmas ever in it.
Christmas.
And of course, The Lion in Winter, my favorite Christmas movie. Which is just like getting together with your family at Christmas, only with better dialogue.
Getting together with your family at Christmas?
The dialogue's not as good, and nobody in my family is quite as good looking as Katharine Hepburn.
You know, I will add to your list for all that getting me to squee about the movie actually requires a deconstructive approach to the text that makes most people kind of wince. The I Am Legend remake in 2009 with Will Smith, well, part of how they get the virus to spread so quickly is by kicking it off during Christmas. So it's the end of the world. Here, have zombies. The movie itself is Will Smith versus the zombies. It is kind of the stealth Christmas film. I find that it becomes much more enjoyable if you look at the fact that they used measles as their medium for their viral cancer cure, which has never stayed non-airborne for more than four generations in a lab setting, and view the entire movie as the aftermath of the most successful act of bioterrorism in human history.
Woohoo!
Merry Christmas, I've wiped out mankind.
Sean and Maguire, still not on our side.
I'm supposed to be?
I've now reconfigured the movie completely in my head as a result of that, and see it all differently now, yes.
It's so much better!
I was going to say, it's even approaching good.
Yeah!
So I guess the lesson that I draw from this non-exhaustive list of movies is that there's a bunch of different ways you can use Christmas as a thematic element that are not just, oh, it's the holidays and now we get to have a heartwarming ending.
So I have a couple examples. And for me, the early Harry Potter movies, before they get all dark, are very Christmassy, even though they only partly take part at Christmas.
That's true.
There's something about the first two that just read as Christmas to me so hard. When I was growing up, our version of It's a Wonderful Life was The Bishop's Wife, not the recent one with, well, somewhat recent with Whitney Houston, but the old one with Cary Grant. That was one of my mother's favorite movies. But now, a little while ago, I married into a Russian family, and so Christmas has become a very different sort of thing. They celebrate New Year instead of Christmas because Stalin has stolen Christmas for many, many years. In Russia. And so everything is the same, only it's New Year. It's a New Year's tree and New Year's carols and things like that. And their version of It's a Wonderful Life, the beloved movie that airs every year, is called With Light Steam. And it is so, so far and beyond different than anything that we in our wholesomeness-obsessed culture would put on television every year. Strikes me as SF, even though it isn't. Although it's very sort of magical realist, that sort of totalitarian magical realism thing. The plot is that there's a guy who's going to get married in the morning, and he goes out to get drunk with all of his friends. And he gets so drunk that he has no memory of getting into a plane in Moscow and flying to St. Petersburg, presumably to drink more, getting off the plane and not realizing that he's not home because he's so drunk. The punchline of all of this is that Moscow and St. Petersburg look exactly the same because of all the prefab Soviet-era buildings. So all the buildings look the same, all the streets have the same names, all the addresses are the same. So he goes to what he thinks is home, a building that looks just like his building, and to his apartment, which looks just like his apartment because they're all pre-assigned and so they all look the same, and falls asleep on what he presumes is his couch. Wakes up in the morning to discover another woman in the apartment because it is, in fact, her apartment. Obviously, they're soulmates, and the rest of the movie sort of follows them leaving their respective partners and getting together. In the Russian version of romantic comedies, which I assure you is not comedic. From my perspective, everyone loves it. Like, I've been sitting there with my Russian family, and they love this movie. It's so beloved. It flies over my head in a lot of ways, but it led to me understanding what was going on with the other Christmas tradition, New Year's tradition, which is Russian satellite TV airs this constant dinner theater, which has like young boy band type things singing old World War II songs and all kinds of other music I never recognized until I figured out a lot of it's the soundtrack to this movie. And I suppose that if there was a dinner theater that aired every Christmas that sang like old Muppet songs and things like that, I would love it too. So it led to me understanding that a little more. Although I do think that the constant dinner theater is a portal into actual hell. Songs are always the same. The people are always kind of sort of the same. They always have the same old woman who cries at the World War II song. They have food and drink, but you never see anyone eat the food or drink the drink. The champagne in the glasses never goes down. And no matter what holiday it is, you see in the same dinner theater, it's International Women's Day or it's Easter or it's Christmas. It's always the same. So my Christmases have been Russian SF Fantastica for quite some time.
When you said it was the Russian It's a Wonderful Life, I thought you were going to say Solaris. the British have two what might be called associational Christmas movies. That is to say, things that have nothing to do with Christmas, which are The Wizard of Oz, which is probably international, you know. Well, at least that's a well-loved children's movie that you might expect to be on television at Christmas. The other one is The Great Escape. Nothing to do with Christmas. Rather the grim World War II movie, which everybody dies at the end. Spoilers. And yet, it's become a Christmas British television staple. Who knows why? Sheer tradition. Mere tradition.
The sheer joy of watching David McCallum get shot in the back.
Well, I could watch that time after time.
That's just such a fabulously overplayed death scene. I love it.
Well, it seems to me that it might be sort of a reactionary thing in the same way that right around Christmas, over here, one of the cable networks, Spike, tends to run a James Bond marathon during Christmas so that when things get a little too treacly, you can go watch Bond killing people.
Take me with you. I won't be a burden to you. Take me with you in your tunnel.
Well, I think that comes back to the Die Hard Running Scared Lethal Weapon thing, the reactiveness of it. Or Brazil. Why set Brazil at Christmas? Because we needed to make it a little more awful. This movie isn't awful enough. How could we make it more awful and depressing? I know, it's the holiday.
Well, I'm just going to bring up a New Year's movie because I'm a sucker for it, which is When Harry Met Sally, which is still one of my favorite. I have to admit, I'm a cheesy Christmas person. I'm one of those people who will sit and watch every stupid Christmas special on ABC Family for an entire month. Like, you know, everything that had minor sitcom star. I will sit through it gladly and I will cry my eyes out at the sentimental stuff and I will be like, this is the best thing ever. I don't know why.
Oh, thank goodness there's somebody. That's great. Thank you. Thank you.
I am such a sucker for these things. I have sat through Santa Baby with Jenny McCarthy like 8 times now.
I do believe that Christmas episode was Lynn's idea.
Hey man, Santa Baby is a good film.
Okay.
My favorite Christmas movie, which is not genre at all, I think is A White Christmas. It's so post-traumatic stress disorder movie. It's so about the Second World War. Bing is just terrifically hurt. And it's a bunch of people wandering around trying to get over being horribly, horribly harmed. It's just beautiful.
My friend Kate, who honestly, if we had non-genre professionals come in as guests, I would have just brought her in and been like, yeah, y'all, I'm not talking today. Because she loves Christmas movies the way that I love My Little Ponies and Pumpkin Byproducts. She's been making me watch all the old Christmas movies that I managed to miss because when I was a teenager, which is where most of us absorbed the older Christmas movies, at least where I am, if you gave me a choice between It's a Wonderful Life and Silent Night, Bloody Night 4, Santa's Revenge, I was in the room where the screaming was. And she just made me watch White Christmas for the very first time this last winter. And Paul's right. It is absolutely the PTSD holiday film. It's brilliant.
Did you blub?
I blubbed. Of course I blubbed. I'm a blubber. Good. I blub at commercials. I also blub at the Doctor Who theme song every time there's a new season because part of me is convinced it's just going to go away again. So the very first episode of a new season, I have to pause midway through the theme because I'm crying.
Well,
so I'm a blubber.
Doctor Who, the Christmas specials have absolutely become a tradition around our house.
Oh, yes.
And because of that, all of Doctor Who tends to feel kind of Christmassy to me. Because, you know, every 12 or 13 episodes, you'll get a Christmas episode. So it kind of flavors the whole thing. So we often have Doctor Who marathons around Christmas.
I think the creation of Doctor Who Christmas specials is actually making concrete a feeling of Christmasness that was always there amongst Doctor Who fans and thus the people who make modern Doctor Who. And so, because that was always the time of year where we got new Doctor Who books, and it was always running through the winter period, so there would be a Doctor Who episode near Christmas anyway. I think this is just kind of making real the feeling of spookiness. There's always something spooky about Christmas. A Ghost Story for Christmas, M.R. James, that BBC tradition of doing a ghost story season at Christmas. And thus Doctor Who kind of suits that peeling back the veil feel of Christmas as well.
Well, it's kind of the death of the year, isn't it? And I mean, you get that in Dickens as well.
Oh, yeah.
Well, not only that, but one of the things we've talked about, I've talked about on, I can't even count how many Doctor Who panels now, is the notion that Doctor Who as a series has an overall sort of positive take on the universe. So, you know, that's part of why it feels so Christmassy, because even when there are really large body counts, somehow there's some kind of happy ending because the Doctor has fixed whatever's wrong in some manner. It's not that it doesn't have dark moments, but overall the vision of the show is much more positive and, as Sarah Monette would say, Claire, rather than noir.
Yeah.
Pat Valenti should write a Doctor Who book. Seriously, I think that would be tremendous. I think that would be just spot on.
There are many adorable puppies I would kill in order to do that.
Not mine.
No, you don't have any. Oh, sorry, you're not Shannon. Your voice sounds so much like Shannon that sometimes I get confused. You do have puppies.
No, that was Shannon.
Wait, you don't
that
have
was
any.
Shannon.
You can't have my puppy either.
Yeah, I don't have any puppies right now, but I really want a bulldog puppy, and they're about the most adorable things on this planet, so I am preemptively putting in a bid for you not to kill my puppy.
Get your hands off my puppies.
Dispensation given to Sean and
Paul! We don't know each other that well. I actually had one more movie that I was saving to the end of the discussion, which is a movie that pretends to be a Christmas movie, but kind of isn't. A Christmas Story.
I love that movie. Love it.
It really, really tries very hard to make itself look like a Christmas movie, but it's not about Christmas at all.
Having lived in Cleveland for several years, it kind of killed it for me. Cleveland kind of has a Christmas Story industry going on. I really liked it until I moved there.
I married into a family that in many ways behaved like the family in A Christmas Story, and it gave me a new and abiding love for the thing. It's a great character study and a great study of a certain portion of the American lifestyle that had previously been completely opaque to me, shall we say.
reason that it's so popular is that it's not nearly as schmaltzy as a lot of the Christmas stuff out there. Like, it's the diehard of the...
Diehard of the cute kid Christmas movies.
Well, better that than Home Alone. Ugh.
I have
wow. Link's the one that harsh the squee.
Wow. I'm sorry. I'm not a Home Alone fan. I'm sorry.
I only like the first one, and I only like it a little bit, but I don't know. Like,
I love Catherine O'Hara.
And I do love Catherine O'Hara so much that, like, I'm willing to watch it just for her parts in it. But it is actually far more quotable than one would think on first blush.
Yeah.
I'm just making myself laugh by thinking of various lines from it now, so.
See? Yeah, no, I completely grant the quotability of Home Alone. Also, you can still make my mother, who had three small children of the appropriate age, to think that movie was awesome, cringe, and look like she wants to punch you if you just slap her hands to your cheeks and go, ah! Like, seriously, it is an atavistic reaction. Very little else gets that out of her.
And weirdly, it was the first time I was young when that came out. This is the first time I'd heard The Carol of the Bell. It's in the soundtrack. And that was the first time I'd heard that song, which is an amazing song.
Another stealth Christmas movie that I think we all kind of missed, but Kat just made me realize, the Addams Family movie. It opens with them pouring boiling oil on carolers.
Oh, yeah.
I trot that out every Christmas when people start going, I want to watch this, and it's so sweet, and I want to watch that, and it's so sweet. What did you bring, Seanan? The Addams Family. And it's about true love and family and finding your home and pouring boiling oil on small children.
I'm all for it.
Yay. Okay.
Well, now that we've...
This wasn't what you expected, is it, Lynn? We've led you down some dark pathways this evening.
That's okay. I've got to go into the dark sometime.
This is probably what you get for making Seanan and I talk about Christmas.
I know. It serves me right. It does. That's okay. We all have our different traditions. I mean, the funny thing is that for me, Christmas becomes more and more vaguely British without me ever having spent a Christmas in Britain. And
we do own it, you know.
Well, yeah. You know, it's more just that because the Christmas-themed episodes of the TV shows that we love the most tend to be the British ones. We have these little mini marathons where we'll sit there and watch a Christmas episode of Father Ted and the Christmas episode of The Vicar of Dibley and then several of the Doctor Who specials and then, of course, the Blackadder Christmas Carol.
I didn't know there was a Blackadder Christmas Carol.
Oh, there is.
Oh.
It's brilliant. It is so awesome.
Lynn?
Yes, Seanan?
Are you saying the Phineas and Ferb Christmas special isn't great?
No, I am not saying that in the least. It is also fantastic. In fact, we nearly picked up the Phineas and Ferb Christmas album this weekend. It's coming soon.
So worth it.
Yes. We're waiting until we're a little further in and it goes on sale, but it's definitely in our sights this year. No, Phineas and Ferb is awesome.
Every telefantasy show should have a Christmas episode. I think The Prisoner should have done a very Prisoner Christmas. I think Blake 7 should have done a Christmas episode.
There needs to be a Christmas Wire episode.
Warehouse 13 does Christmas episodes every year. I think that's brilliant.
Yeah, so does Eureka. Now I want to see the Christmas episode of Haven where, like, half the town turns into a flesh-eating Wendigo and starts storming the mall, because it would be a very Stephen King Christmas, and it would fill me with such joy.
Well, I mean, Xena Warrior Princess has a Christmas episode. Kat, you had decided you were going to tell us about Hogfather, the Terry Pratchett Discworld novel. So why don't you go ahead and do that?
So I love Hogfather. It is way beyond my regular love for books. It's right up there on my top 10 of all time. And I do love Christmas, not to the extent of watching Santa Baby. There are lines that I cannot cross, one of them. But I do love Christmas. And it's in large part because I discovered Hogfather several years ago. In fact, I listened to it on audiobook, which is how I listen to all Terry Pratchett books, because Nigel Planer is the most amazing audio reader that I have ever heard, and his renditions of Pratchett's characters. I can't read the text. I want to hear how Nigel does it. So I was listening to it while driving a U-Haul to Maine on November 1st, so just teetering into the holiday season. And just as I was crossing the boundary into Maine, which, by the way, has a sign that says, Maine, the way life should be, I was listening to the end of Hogfather and just sobbing. For a book to make me think differently about folklore, given what I do this late in life, is extraordinary anyway. It made me think about Christmas in a completely different way. Hogfather is, I suppose, ostensibly part of the death arc of the Discworld novels. It is one of his sort of single joke novels. He does sometimes the Discworld books, like Moving Pictures or Soul Music, sort of is a continual riff on one thing, the music industry or the movie industry, as in the case of those two books. And Hogfather, I had known for quite some time, was the Santa Claus book. And I was convinced that it would be schmaltzy and stupid, and I would not like it, so I just wasn't going to read it. But my husband talked me into reading it, and I did. So Santa Claus, who is the Hogfather in the book, has had a contract on his life taken out by more or less the forces of entropy in the universe, and death has to take Santa Claus's place and deliver the presents. That sounds like an okay premise, but what Pratchett does with it is it's just so affecting. And Susan, Death's granddaughter, who is well known by Discworld fans for being awesome, is sort of the heroine of the book. If there is, there's a lot of heroes and protagonists going on. I'm not really sure that I would say that she is the single protagonist, but she certainly is a mover and shaker. And it's always wonderful to see a Discworld novel that is moved and shaken by a woman. There is a movie, which is now on our Christmas every year list. We do Hogswatch instead of, I used to do goose and Yorkshire pudding and all that crap for Christmas, because I grew up in California where we had to make little cutouts of snowflakes and things like that, even though there would never be any snow on Christmas. So when I moved to the East Coast, it was as though I had entered the real world for the first time. And so I make pork pies and sherry, and we either listen to it or watch it every year. The movie is quite good. It can never be as good or as affecting as the book. But Hogfather, to me, makes Christmas serious. There is a point in the book where all of a sudden all the jokes fall away, and it is serious, hardcore folklore. And he talks about, I don't want to spoil it, even though I'm sure everybody's already read it, but all of the talk about what Santa Claus is really about, of the sacrifice of the year, of the end of the year, and blood on the snow and all of that, it makes Christmas so real to me, and it has Hogfather saved Christmas for me.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
When I finally arrived in Maine, Susan, Death's granddaughter, beats the crap out of monsters with a poker in the beginning of the book. And when I walked into my new house in Maine, there was a poker lying on my fireplace. Our Christmas miracle.
That is joy. That is joy.
Hogwatch here.
I love Discworld like burning, and Hogfather is my favorite for a lot of the reasons that Kat cites. It is a joy absolutely forever. The folklore is beautiful, and Susan is beautiful in that book. She's my favorite of Pratchett's protagonists, and watching her come to terms with the fact that you can't escape your myth completely, you can change it, but you are a part of your own story, all set against this amazing folkloric background. And, you know, Paul mentioned earlier that the British own Christmas. In some ways, he's right. I don't think Hogfather is a book that could have been written by any American author, because you required those hundreds of years of Christmas traditions that we've kind of put in little boxes. And we remember, wasn't it quaint back when we used to bake beans into bread, and back when there was kind of possibly a chance that maybe Cousin Dave was going to be sacrificed to bring the sun back, as something other than quaint stories that people tell. It had to be a British author because it is such a rooted in hands-on experience of that folklore narrative. It's a beautiful book.
Well, most of folklore narrative of Christmas comes from Germany, but thanks to our succession of very German kings, we imported it, changed it, and gave it to you.
Well, and I do think that a lot of that weather stuff comes from England rather than New England specifically. Having grown up in places where trees didn't really turn red and we weren't really going to get snow, there is a very strange dissonance with what Christmas is supposed to be. And the only time I ever saw that, really, was on television and in the movies. And a lot of those were British television and British movies. So, yeah, Christmas is very much a British time for me anyway, especially because now it's Hogwarts. I mean, what better way to bring books into the holidays than to actually have this fantasy book mean so much to so many people? I am not the only person who holds Hogwatch. Many, many people do. Also, pork pies are easier to make than goose.
The next thing on the list is The Avengers. Too Many
Yay.
Christmas Trees. The reason I picked this is because I wanted an excuse to watch this again. I am a sucker for the 60s, what's the term, spy-fi. The spy shows from the 60s, like the Avengers and The Saint, where, again, the version of the world that they live in is one that is completely science fictional in the sense that it does not abide by the regular rules. The way that you vanquish your enemies in Avengers land is that you dunk them in water, or you do one little judo chop and they fall to to the ground and they are vanquished. For me, the Avengers is just such a joyful, joyful thing. And Too Many Christmas Trees, which is the Avengers Christmas episode, and it's very specifically the Steed and Peele Christmas episode, is one of the most beloved by Avengers fandom, from what I gather. And it's one of my favorites. It's just so much fun. You have this weird serendipitous... Well, it's not really serendipitous. You have this weird grouping of this very Dickensian Christmas. Again, the English who invented Christmas, right, Paul? Where you've got a Dickens collector who's hosting a house party. But at the same time, you have this weird swinging 60s Christmas thing going on with these fake Christmas trees and mirrors everywhere. And what is it with the evil-looking Santas? Why is Father Christmas so scary? The baseline of the story is that you have a bunch of people who are using psychic powers to try to steal state secrets out of Steed's head, and how he and Mrs. Peele figure this out in the middle of a Dickensian Christmas party and foil the baddies while flirting with each other constantly. It is just a thing of joy, and I have such deep affection for this episode and for the Avengers in general, and particularly the Steed and Peele run. I was like, yay, Avengers! So that was something I wanted to talk about because I just love it so hard.
The black and white Emma Peele season of the Avengers, I think, is the absolute height of it. It never filmed better, it's never played better, it's never written better, and the balance between the real world and Avengerland is just this beautiful thin tightrope that seems to be moderated just entirely by the upper classness of our two heroes. It's almost as if their world is so refined and so posh that it borders on fairyland, just quite naturally.
I think it's Patrick McNee and Diana Rigg's ability to just deadpan their way through everything. I am on the record as loathing dream sequences with a great and abiding passion. So, of course, I'm currently working on a book that's full of them, but that's besides the point. And Too Many Christmas Trees is full of dream sequences. And yet, in this case, I really like them because they build tension. They are actually creepy. And there's Patrick McNee kind of walking through it all with this faintly bemused expression, as if anything could happen at any moment, but it won't surprise him. And I think the actors carry that Avengers weirdness a lot for me.
I think Patrick McNee is perhaps the greatest television lead that ever lived. I mean, he and Diana Rigg are very much equal. And I think that that's about as far into horror-struck and flustered as it's possible for Patrick McNee to go. He looks just a little disturbed. Slightly moved by the experience.
Bemused. I think bemused.
Yes, he is vaguely perturbed.
A little disconcerted, perhaps.
Anything but more would be totally infradict.
Well, it's Steed. This is a man who, you know, at various points in the series, goes riding off on a white horse to save somebody and then jousts them with a picket sign, you know?
Can I just share with you my absolute favorite Emma Peele moment?
Yes.
It's in an otherwise... I do think that the creator, Brian Clemens, writes, in some ways, the worst Avengers episodes, because his are so sort of central and generic, and it's people playing off that that's really good. But in the episode Epic, where Peter Wingard has Emma strapped down in front of a circular saw, and she just looks calmly up at him as he's gloating over her and goes, "Gloat all you want, but just remember who's the star of this picture."
Yeah, that pretty much encapsulates the Avengers in a nutshell right there. I do find myself repeatedly, though, if I'm watching a run of episodes, saying, "Emma, don't gloat." That's my one thing, is that Emma has this tendency, after vanquishing people by dunking them in water or a well-placed judo toss, has this tendency to sort of stand over them and gloat for a moment, which allows then the fight to continue. So I'm constantly yelling at the screen, "Emma, don't gloat!"
She pauses to gloat and somebody sneaks up behind her with a gun.
Yes, exactly. Oh, I just have such affection for the Avengers. It's so joyful and so completely ludicrous, and they're also self-aware of how ludicrous it is, and they think it's hilarious, and it's just wonderful. And I can't love the show more. Seriously, I just can't.
Well, my favorite Avengers episode is the one where it's the bottle show and absolutely nothing happens except Steed and Peele wandering around an abandoned airfield bantering.
They wander like nobody else, and it's shot so wonderfully. It's this beautiful summer's day.
And there's 45 minutes of wandering and bantering, and then 5 minutes of plot at the end, and then we all get to go home. But what more could you want? Couldn't do that today, I'm afraid. They'd make you actually have scene breaks or something.
Yeah, alas, that kind of plotting at this point would be relegated to fan fiction for the most part.
Thank God for fan fiction.
Well, and of course, the other thing that I love about Too Many Christmas Trees is the very, very slight nod at the beginning of the episode to Honor Blackman. Because one of the wonderful throwaways in this episode is that Emma gets Steed's mail and they start opening his group of Christmas cards. And it's all of these cards from, you know, from women that he has fond memories of being Steed. And she hands over one that says it's from Kathy. And he says, ah, Mrs. Gale, wonder what she's been up to. And then he says, what on earth is she doing at Fort Knox? And of course, that's a reference to the fact that at that point, Honor Blackman is now in Goldfinger. So it's just like,
as if John Steed has a conventional sexuality of any kind. I mean, he's such a bachelor. He's more a bachelor than anybody else ever on British television.
Well, you can see it that way if you like.
Well, rather like the Doctor in everything previous to Christopher Eccleston.
Again, you can see it that way if you like.
I don't know. I have to say that even in the episode under discussion, there's a moment at the end where he's dangling mistletoe over Mrs. Peel's head.
Yeah, that's pretty...
He gets beyond dangling, though, does he?
Well, that's where the scene ends. The camera draws back and they ride off into the sunset.
Well, it is a wide shot. And if you look very carefully, not that I have done this, of course, if you look very carefully in the wide shot, McNee does actually lean in a little bit. So it is left to the imagination, unless you're one of those obsessive fans who goes through
frame by frame.
But I wouldn't know. This is going to be something where we agree to disagree, Paul, because I actually have firm beliefs about Stevie Peel and the Doctor, for that matter, that violently disagree with yours. But that's okay.
Brian Clemens always thought that Stephen Peel had an affair a long time ago and it's all over.
Oh, yeah. But the point is, there was one there. Certainly the comfort with which they wander in and out of each other's apartments, I think, is an indication that they at some point have indeed.
I have a feeling about the show and about those two that there's something perfectly feminist about their partnership. It's almost as if they enjoy the benefits of having a sexuality without letting it oppress Emma Peel in any way. And that's such a unique partnership that Clemens having to formulate it in such conventional terms really annoys me. It's almost as if people throughout the history of the show have to find a good reason why Steed isn't shagging his female partners.
Well, her name is Mrs. Peel, and the last reveal when Diana Rigg leaves the show, spoilers, is that she gets into a convertible with someone who looks suspiciously like Patrick McNee, who happens to be Mr. Peel. So...
Peter Peel.
Yeah, exactly. I think that what you have there is two people who have deep affection for each other who may have had an affair at some point, but she's married to someone else and he's away. And,
She's widowed, I believe.
Until she gets in the car with him.
Until he, mysteriously comes back.
Exactly.
In the New Avengers, they always had some appropriately aged woman hanging around Steed at his house, which I always thought just was ridiculous, but there we are.
Well, yeah.
I think that's pushing it too far, but I think having that relationship between John and Emma, it's a very interesting relationship from my perspective in that there are moments when she professes jealousy, but then in the midst of a party, he'll just up and wander off and go talk to some other attractive woman, and she's amused.
Yeah, she's always amused. I mean, that's
she's
just always, it.
Even when she's jealous, she's amused.
It's almost like they don't have the power to hurt each other, or they have such intimate trust that, my goodness, we're all fans of this show, aren't we?
I am glad it makes you happy.
We ought to do a special. You guys who haven't seen it ought to see one each, and we ought to do a special where we all do one.
Oh, the Avengers.
If we do that, I'm claiming House that Jack built right now.
I want the new Avengers episode, the only good one, Dead Men Are Dangerous, which kind of sums up the show.
I'll have to look through my collection and see what appeals to me.
Oh, we got to do the cat one.
Oh, with that wonderful line. Sorry, we're totally...
Okay, we're doing that thing, guys.
Well, you know, it's about squeeing, and what you got was all of us on a roll. So does what it says on the tin, as it were. Paul, Paul wanted to talk about the most classic of American Christmas films, 1946's It's a Wonderful Life, starring James Stewart. It was nominated for 5 Oscars, did not win any, and at the time, it didn't make its money back. It was not considered a huge success when it came out. It's a Frank Capra film, but it is now held up by the American Film Institute as one of the 100 best American films ever, and it is often called by the AFI one of the most inspirational American films of all time. So, Paul, take it away.
Well, I think it's difficult coming to something like this as a believer. For me, the whole Christmas season is a kind of ecstatic build-up in which I exhaust myself by writing 12 blogs in 12 days and then kind of plunge into a wonderful darkness. It and the Hugo Awards are perhaps the two poles around which my year revolves. And It's a Wonderful Life, I think, is a tremendously spiritual film. Basically, its message is, you're all bastards. That people are evil sods when you come down to it, and they're evil sods because of money. It's a Wonderful Life is a hymn to the power of redemption against the power of money. And at this point in time when we're living in Pottersville, in the town created by, opposite to our lovely, lovely hero, I'm skipping over the idea that any of you may not actually know the plot to It's a Wonderful Life. It's influenced so much of pop culture since it was made that you're bound to get the idea anyway. It's about karma. It's about investing in people for no good reason. Basically, the entire town leans on our hero and relies on him to be good for them. He takes it and takes it and takes it and finally breaks. It's a very, very dark movie. I'm not normally one of those people who think that things have to be dark to be good. I think that's a very adolescent attitude. It's one of the reasons that, you know, I love Christmas and Christmas movies. They don't have to be bad. They don't have to be schmaltzy. The fact that there are a million of them that are, well, you know, one doesn't have to live in that million. One can live in the good ones, like It's a Wonderful Life. It's a late text for Frank Capra, the director. It's past what Hollywood at the time thought of as his good years. It's hard won. It's him trying desperately to find something in this story. He revised the ending so many times. There are great parallels. It's kind of a... Let me put out a kind of historical timeline for you. There's A Christmas Carol, the prototypical parallel universe Christmas story that leads into A Matter of Life and Death and It's a Wonderful Life, which were released within 11 days of each other in 1946, so can't really have been said to influence each other, and thence into every single time travel character episode of your favorite telefantasy show brings out of that continuum. It and A Matter of Life and Death both start cosmically with a view of space and voices talking up there. They both have a very human angel who comes down to Earth and enjoys being part of humanity and takes on human characteristics. I think that this indicates these two movies and the thread they come from are part of a vast general feeling post-World War II. Matter of Life and Death is about the battle for the soul of one person. It's a Wonderful Life is about the battle for the soul of a town. It's about this just post-World War II is a time of great choice. And the message of It's a Wonderful Life is you really can't flee the bastards. You have to forgive them. The town are rotten to our hero, George, and he's about to commit suicide. You watch this, you know, it takes you by surprise just how dark it gets. It's not a children's movie. Children will be asking, what's he about to do? He's about to kill himself because he's been driven to a nervous breakdown by something approaching a horror story about capital, a kind of Marxist zombie movie where the mob have finally got to him. Interestingly enough, Potter, the representative of capital and the mob, is Lionel Barrymore, who was also the most famous Scrooge. Can you imagine what Christmas was like for Lionel Barrymore? He is the two biggest Christmas bogeyman. I assume that in his private life he must have been fantastic and gave gifts to all the good children all the time just to get past it. At the end of the movie, well, our hero learns nothing, actually, apart from the fact that he's appreciated and loved. It's the townsfolk, actually, who learn the major lesson. That is to say that they shouldn't be a bastard to the only good person in town who's kept on saving them. People think that this is kind of like The Prisoner, that the message is he should stay put and not go away on his holiday. I think he can go away on his holiday, you know, he can go off for a weekend break next week after the end of the movie, because the townspeople will finally let him. They have had their minds changed. He's been the good guy all along. It's his sacrifice. Now, I would say that this is what makes this the ultimate Christmas movie in a lot of ways, that for believers like me, the sacrifice is connected to the birth. The point where the curtain is pulled back at Halloween and one can see all the different versions of the world continues into the feeling of Christmas, where the numinous starts to impinge on life. And George Bailey is one of, like David Niven in A Matter of Life and Death, numerous avatars for Christ who appear throughout Western culture. He is actually prevented from sacrificing himself because the crowd, you know, Pontius Pilate, etc., are turned around at the last minute. And it's basically the story of victory of humanity over money. If all the bad Christmas movies are about money, are about sentimentality and schmaltziness and buying lots of things, and how somehow this process of buying things can lead to fun and joy and things, and this is what undermines our feelings of warmth in the season. It's A Matter of Life and Death is just cold, 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 cold. It's about a boy dying under a frozen lake, and it's about George about to follow him until we find that hard-won heart to it. And that hard-won heart is about sacrifice, and this is why this is the greatest movie ever made. Ipso facto, my case rests. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Ho, ho, ho. Merry Christmas.
Paul wins! Paul wins. I can't follow that.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas.
Tell me that's in the public domain.
It is.
Actually, it's not. It's a Wonderful Life is not in the public domain. Never was. Urban legend.
I meant Merry Little Christmas. I'm pretty sure that is.
Oh bollocks.
You sang less than 30 seconds, so I am now going to demonstrate the power of We're All at Our Computers and find out if that's in the public domain. And if it is, we will have ourselves a merry sing-along. And if it's not, we will all say that we're very sorry to the copyright people and point out again that that was less than 30 seconds. We live in the future. La, 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 la. Okay, it turns out that that is listed on the 10 Christmas songs you thought were public domain but are not by Rights Workshop. So have yourself a merry little Christmas.
Is there another list of ones that actually are?
I'm now going to find that out because that is absolutely a part of our purpose. Angels We Have Heard on High is in the public domain. Away in a Manger.
Wow.
Which arrangement?
I don't want you guys to have to sing a Christian song. Let's go for something festive rather than...
I was going to say that God Rest You Merry Gentlemen is my favorite, even though I'm...
Yeah, Three Three Kings because it's got the goth verse.
Oh, Three Three Kings of Oriental, in a taxi, one in a car.
We Wish You a Merry Christmas is in the public domain, and it involves home invasion and demanding desserts from strangers.
the all animal version, Be Fish You a Merry Gretzmoose.
12 Days of Christmas, of course, is public domain, as is Silent Night, O Little Town of Bethlehem, and The Holly and the Ivy.
Town of Bethlehem. I will just be in floods of tears. That is my all-time favorite thing ever.
I actually learned all 79 alternate verses of The Holly and the Ivy in seventh grade to piss off my chorus teacher. So that song has a very dear place in my heart.
What about the one with figgy pudding?
Figgy pudding! We wish you a Merry Christmas. We wish you a Merry Christmas.
Christmas we.
And a happy New Year.
And a happy New Year.
And a happy New Year.
Bring us some figgy pudding. Yes, bring us some figgy pudding. Now bring us some figgy pudding and bring it right here.
We won't go until we get some. We won't go until we get some.
We won't go until we get some. We won't go until we get some.
We need to rehearse, guys.
Yeah.
I want to commit to it.
I just think that I want someone to promise me a dessert if I'm going to go all the way through this thing.
I think that's fair.
You heard it here first, ladies and gentlemen. Sure. Shannon will go all the way for dessert.
That's right.
Okay, Bear, I'll be at your house in approximately 3 hours. And if
it didn't happen.
Ho, ho, ho.
That sounded more like Green Giant.
Like the Christmas little girl.
Well, if you're the Green Giant, I'd like to shake you and have a lot of asparagus fall out. When I was a kid, because I actually really love vegetables, I was that weird child that was all, ooh, more broccoli? And the Green Giant, like, he shakes his hands and vegetables fall from the sky. So I had a fairly elaborate plan involving a beanstalk and mugging the Green Giant, which no one had the heart to tell me wasn't going to work out.
As as a special treat for the holidays to our listeners, Seanan, who has thus far avoided all of the questions, now gets to answer them. So, Seanan, are you ready?
I am ready.
Okay. Paul would like to know, what do you most fear?
Whatever it is Thomas is going to bring into the room next. My cat has been bringing me horrible things this whole podcast, but actually what I most fear is clowns and pudding.
Figgy pudding specifically or generic pudding?
Figgy pudding is fine because figgy pudding does not share the texture of generic American pudding. I also don't mean pudding in the British sense where it's dessert. I mean basically custard. It's going to eat me back. I'm terrified of the stuff. You can make me throw up and run away if you just sit down and start eating a bowl of pudding at my table. I don't recommend doing this as a party trick because I did have one person decide that I was either kidding or exaggerating for comic effect, sit down next to me at a convention on a panel with a bowl of pudding, put a big bite in their mouth and then go, I'm gonna go, and show me their food. And then I barfed in their pudding and ran away crying.
One of the more memorable Worldcon battles.
Yeah, I'm terrified and disgusted by pudding. So pudding and clowns.
Okay. You'd like to know if you can have a cookie.
I can't have a cookie. In fact, I'm not going to answer the rest of the questions because I'm going to go get a cookie. Bye.
Oh.
Kidding.
Come back, Seanan.
Seanan, don't leave me. Oh, I won't leave you with these people there.
No, that was actually
That was me. That was me.
We all have interchangeable voices.
Apparently. So
thank goodness you sound different.
Seanan, what is the first book that you remember reading on your own initiative?
Hamlet.
Seriously.
Seriously. I was six. I had been told that I could not possibly read Hamlet. My aunt, who thought that small children were invented to be psychological experiments, taught me how to write Shakespearean sonnets the summer before kindergarten by telling me that they were an exercise in counting to 10. And then I read Hamlet. I did not understand Hamlet. I did not really quite get the point of Hamlet. I got kicked out of kindergarten for the first time for claiming to have read Hamlet and refusing to back down, but that was the first book I read under my own initiative. The first one I read and fully understood under my own initiative that I really remember is Watership Down, which I found when I was 9 and had not considered was the kind of story people were allowed to tell.
Neat.
We really were separated at birth.
We were. It's creepy.
I read Watership Down at a similar age, and it took me 3 chapters before I realized these were rabbits.
That's kind of awesome.
Okay. Seanan, what have you done today to make Paul feel proud?
I got up at 6 a.m. and started working, and I have written 4,782 words, many of which were done during the quiet parts of this podcast.
Woot.
Wow.
Wow.
That is some serious word count.
Come on, Paul.
I'm proud. I'm very, very proud.
Thank you. You have to say it or it doesn't count.
Yeah, it's been difficult when you haven't been here, Paul, because we've tried to make you proud in your absence, and it's not been easy.
Yeah, we have to do our Paul impressions, like, I'm proud of you.
That's Odin. I think you're fine.
Paul? You mean you're not Odin? You lied to me?
Paul has 2 eyes.
I have depth perception.
We'll hang him on a tree for you if you want.
Really?
Oh, let's not go through all that again, please.
Oh, Seanan, Bear would like to know, what do you want on your tombstone?
We're really not quite sure how she managed to die that way. I actually don't want a tombstone. I have in my will that I will be given to the body farm. They've already agreed to take my body, despite the fact that they currently have a plethora of corpses available. So we'll have to have some little monument or memorial, because my family is insane, so they'll make something. And I would really like it to have inscribed something like, here lies Seanan, or whatnot. We don't know where she found 73 tons of candy corn, but we're sure she drowned happy.
So Seanan, you were just creepy again, because what I would like to have done with my mortal remains is also to go to the anthropological research facility. So
I have the paperwork for committing yourself to the body farm so that you can actually get pre-approval that they'll take you, even if they have a sufficiency of corpses. So let me know and I'll send it to you. It's really simple. And that way you get to decay in the environment of science's choice.
Well, I'd like them to harvest anything useful first, assuming I die at a relatively young age, but we'll see how it goes.
Well, the murder injection...
You should hear it when it's not our festive edition.
Yeah, really. And on that note, what's your favorite joke, Seanan?
Would you like a joke that could be told in front of children?
Probably, preferably, given that this is the holiday edition, yes.
What's brown and sticky?
I don't know, Sean, and what's brown and sticky?
A stick.
Awesome.
Yeah, it's an 8-year-old's favorite joke.
Yes, it's actually part of a 3-part joke, which is, what do you call a boomerang if it comes back?
A stick.
And what kind of car does a dryad drive?
A stick.
If you tell all 3 of them in quick succession and then follow it up with a joke that any other punchline, it is basically guaranteed that someone is going to say a stick, no matter how little sense that makes.
That is comedy gold.
Can we see a 18-rated one?
So a clown and a little girl are walking hand in hand through a dark, scary forest. And the little girl looks up at the clown and says, gosh, this forest is really scary. And the clown looks down at the little girl and says, well, how do you think I feel? I'm going to be walking back alone.
That's awesome.
Wow.
Several of my friends will actually just start handing me money if I say a clown and a little girl to prevent the rest of the joke from being told.
Use that power for good.
That's right. Seanan, what is your quest?
I would like to walk to Maine. My quest is to show up at Kat's house without her having known, but having wondered why I was offline for 3 months.
He's actually a guy from Portland who just walked across the country. My Portland, Maine. He just arrived on the West Coast.
Well, the thing is that for me to walk across the country, which really is a life goal of mine, I'm going to need a very large dog or someone to walk with me, because unfortunately, walking across certain parts of the country while being female is a good way to get that tombstone.
Well, aren't you lucky I have a 110-pound German Shepherd?
Can I borrow your dog, or should I just come to you and then we'll walk to California?
Either way works. Plus, her name is Grimm, like the fairy tale, so she's perfect for us.
This is the best remake of The Incredible Journey ever.
Okay, 2 more questions. We're going to make it through. What is your favorite guilty pleasure, Seanan?
I don't really have guilty pleasures, honestly. I freely admit to all of my pleasures. I listen to country music. I watch reality television. Not all reality television, mostly just Top Model and things of that nature. But still, I eat candy corn and get into fights with people who tell me that candy corn is not food, which does seem to be a many other people's guilty pleasure, is informing you that stuff you like is not food. Honestly, I think if pleasure makes you guilty, unless that pleasure is murdering other people, you should probably stop. And if that pleasure is murdering other people, you should seek help right now.
Stop also first. Stop. Yes. Yes. Stop first.
Then seek help.
Please do not help. Please do not seek help while murdering. That is not helpful.
No, that just creates an accessory.
Somebody in our audience is thinking, they've given me a lot to think about.
Yes, stop murdering. It's not cool.
Seanan, what is your favorite word?
My favorite word. Right now, divagate is my favorite word.
Can you define that? I've never heard that word.
It's an awesome word, isn't it?
It sounds so cool. What is it?
Divagate is actually one of the, it's an extinct word, effectively. It's one of the ones that's so fallen out of common use that it's considered a rare or endangered English word. And it means to wander or to drift about. It is like navigating. But if you're navigating, if I'm going to navigate from my house to Kat's house, I'm going to go to the airport, I'm going to get on a plane, I'm going to very sensibly take direct steps that I have pre-planned to get to Kat. If I'm going to divagate with the eventual goal of winding up at Kat's house, I'm going to leave my house and start walking vaguely eastward. And eventually, I will hit Maine.
How is it spelled?
It is spelled D-I-V-A-G-A-T-E.
Ah.
So no
That's
relation.
That's a very good word.
Yeah, that is a great word.
It's not the same as digressing. It's related, but to digress would be, I'm going to start telling you a story, and then in the middle of it, I'm going to pause a moment to tell you about a cute thing my cat has done, and then I'm going to return to the story. So there was a digression, but I'm still navigating from beginning to end. If I'm going to divagate, I'm going to start at the beginning. I'm going to tell you 73 vaguely interconnected stories, numbers 6, 8, and 43 of which are related to that end point.
So basically a Michael Swanwick novel.
Yes.
Well, on that note, We have come to the end of our podcast. So I want to thank everybody for joining us. Thanks to our regular contributors, Sean and Paul, Kat and Bear. Special thanks to our webmaster, Dimitri Zagdulin, our technical producer, Carol Brown, Jeff Bonhoff at Mystic Fig Studios for the instrumentals of music by Shauna McGuire, Katie Shuttleworth, who made our rockin' logo, and Michael Thomas for general administrative support. We hope that you will join us next time, same squee time, same squee channel, and we hope that you enjoy your winter holidays, whatever they may be. Bye-bye now.
Bye.